Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Gavin Essler. British people sometimes talk about the United States and our special relationship. But any superpower has plenty of special relationships, some more special than others. In the case of the US, the relationship with the State of Israel has always been hugely significant diplomatically, politically, and militarily. Yet right now it seems remarkably troubled. So how far should that relationship be understood as outdated and in need of fresh thinking? It's been reported that Richard Haass, a former top US diplomat and head of the Council on Foreign Relations, has suggested to the Biden administration that they distance themselves from Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu because his military campaign is hurting Biden's popularity at home and US credibility abroad. For his thoughts on whether the US needs to rethink its relations with Netanyahu and by extension with Israel itself, I'm delighted to be joined by Stephen Walt, who's Professor of International Relations at Harvard University and author most recently of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of US Primacy. First, Stephen, this special relationship with Israel, how important is the United States to Israel?
I think the United States is absolutely vital to Israel in a variety of different ways. I mean, over Israel's history, the United States has provided billions of dollars of military aid and economic assistance in earlier periods as well, still running to the tune of, $3 to $4 billion a year, except in special circumstances like the ones we're seeing now when the aid suddenly goes up. But equally important has been the diplomatic protection that the United States has provided Israel in the United Nations. You know, dozens of UN Security Council vetoes, including the ones we've seen in recent months, defending Israel's position in the International Court of Justice and putting pressure on other countries, of course, to do the same thing as well. So I think the amount of support the United States provides is overwhelming and absolutely critical to Israel's well-being.
Well, we all know the old cliche about the person who pays the piper calls the tune, but that doesn't quite seem to be the case in this relationship, does it?
No, that's right. And what makes it a special relationship is the fact that the United States provides all of this support more or less unconditionally. It doesn't matter what Israel does. If it builds settlements on the West Bank that the United States formally opposes, if it bombs Gaza, killing thousands of civilians as it is now, regardless of what Israel does, sometimes going up against specific administrations, the aid will continue to support. And that's largely because of the impact of pro-Israel groups in the United States and the extraordinary influence that they have on our political system.
I was going to say then, how important is Israel to the United States? But you've kind of answered that in a sense. It's largely about domestic politics, is that right? Or also there's a geopolitical thing, which is obviously they're a democracy in the Middle East, which is a kind of rare breed.
Yeah, well, there is a long sort of historic, I think even emotional attachment, many Americans, including people who are not Jewish, to Israel. But I think it's not a critical ally. Remember, Israel's a relatively small country, about 9 million people. The United States is over 330 million people. So the enormous disparity in terms of capabilities here. There used to be sort of two big arguments that were made for why Israel was important. One, that it was our partner in the Middle East. It was a strategic ally back in the Cold War against Soviet allies like Syria or Iraq or Egypt in an earlier period. And also that it was another democracy. It shared the same values. And the problem is that both of those rationales are much less persuasive now. There is no Cold War to be waged. And in some respects, the special relationship is a strategic liability now for the United States. And furthermore, American values and Israeli values are fundamentally at odds in certain ways. Yes, they're both democracies, but the United States is a liberal democracy where everyone is supposed to have equal rights. Israel is conceived and run as a Jewish state where Jews have a privileged position there. And finally, we've had 50 or so years of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. And that's completely inconsistent with American values to have established what is in effect an apartheid system there. So those two rationales, for why Israel is such an important ally for the United States are much less persuasive than they used to be.
In what way, then, is the fighting of Gaza simply revealing some of these fault lines that you're discussing? And how is that impacting on U.S. domestic politics?
Certainly, this is not the first time the United States has looked hypocritical in the eyes of the rest of the world, but you rarely see it quite as starkly as we've seen over the last few months. The response of Brazil's president, President Lula, is, I think, revealing in that regard. And the problem is, we're not simply a bystander in this war. We have been actively helping Israel conduct this campaign in Gaza, which either makes the United States look incredibly insensitive, particularly when we like to talk about human rights, talk about a rules-based order. But in some respects, we also look ineffectual, right? We keep saying, well, we think Israel should behave with more restraint and not do some of the things it's doing. And yet it continues to do them, and the United States does nothing to try and stop them. So I think the damage this is doing to America's image in the world is quite considerable. In terms of American domestic politics, you know, Biden is in a tough spot, right? If he puts a lot of pressure on Israel, he will face pressure from the lobby. He will have trouble raising money for his presidential campaign. So he's in trouble if he goes one way. Of course, if he does what he's been doing, that gets him into trouble with Arab American populations and also with progressives who are very upset by this, including progressive American Jews. I would add something else. I mean, one of Biden's big advantages in 2020 running against Trump was the sense that he was a fundamentally decent human being. You could disagree with him on various issues, but he was a good guy. You know, Joe from Scranton, unlike Trump, nobody really thought Trump was a decent guy. And that, I think, was a part of Biden's appeal. This war, of course, makes him look either clueless or heartless, right? That he's not doing more here. And, you know, we had a primary election in Michigan yesterday. 13% of the Democratic voters in Michigan voted for uncommitted. This was about 100,000 total votes. And Biden won Michigan in 2020 by only 150,000 votes. All right. So if I were the Biden campaign, I would be worried about what the signal that is sending. And it's not that people are necessarily going to vote for Trump to protest against this. They're just going to stay home. They're not going to be willing to vote for Biden because they're upset about his handling of this particular crisis. So in terms of American domestic politics, this could have a non-trivial effect come November.
I mean, there is no easy answer to what Biden should do. Maybe we could start in terms of foreign policy. He's not going to cut Israel loose in any way. He's not going to abandon Israel. And you know, many people would think that would be wrong anyway. So what can he do when he has already said that we think there's some kind of deal, a prisoner swap that could be in the offing and has been proved wrong in that one way or another, despite the fact that, you know, Antony Blinken, American diplomacy is going on full steam ahead and he's being fairly tireless in moving around the region.
Yeah. Blinken has been very tireless. He hasn't been able to deliver very much, although you might be willing to give him credit for making the further escalation of the war less likely, right? That there's been, I think, a considerable effort to keep this from escalating into Lebanon. So you could maybe give the administration some credit for that. I think there are a variety of steps that Biden could take that would indicate his support for Israel, but also indicate that, you know, enough is enough and that, you know, he's sticking to his principles. We could recognize Palestine as a political matter, the way 139 other countries have done. We could support these UN resolutions calling for a ceasefire or abstain from them as a way of indicating that we think the war has gone on long enough. We could reopen the consulate in Jerusalem, which Donald Trump closed, and have that be the U.S. embassy for the Palestinians. It's not the American embassy for Israel. It's the embassy for the Palestinians as well. By the way, Biden promised to reopen that when he was running for president in 2020, but he's never done so. And finally, we could openly support the International Court of Justice investigation into war crimes in Gaza. And that's, by the way, an investigation into war crimes by all parties, so including Hamas as well. This is exactly what the United States did in Ukraine. We support that investigation into war crimes by Russia, possible war crimes by Ukraine. Why not do it in this situation? All of these things do not cut off American support for Israel. And finally, Biden can make it increasingly clear that he thinks the course the Netanyahu government is following is ultimately not good for Israel either, right? And separate himself from Netanyahu, who's not particularly popular in Israel at this point, but is also not popular even with Americans who have a strong feeling towards Israel themselves.
Let me pick up on that point, because it is very well made. However, it is very difficult in the time of conflict to say that you don't support the leader, but you still support the country that leader leads. That's going to be very tricky.
Well, that's why you would be having a special relationship of unconditional support ties our hands, right? And again, you don't have to be make this a personal thing. You can, I think, say that if there's a country you care about that you think is heading in the wrong direction, doing things that are ultimately harmful to it, and also, of course, harmful to American interests as well, then one can say, you know, calmly that you think the state needs to adopt a different set of policies and that you don't support the policies of the Netanyahu government. And you're essentially trying to put the responsibility on a particular leader, the particular coalition he leads, and not say that you're angry at the country as a whole or at the society as a whole. I agree. This is, you know, this is a delicate issue and would have to be handled carefully. But the key is Israelis are going to get the message here, right? And if they believe that the policies of the Netanyahu government are in fact threatening the relationship and the support they get from the United States, that's an additional reason to bring Bibi Netanyahu's political career to an end.
To return to your book and the themes in that, some of which we're exploring, I mean, how far does what's sometimes called the US policy elite get this and get the idea that this is not 1970s, it's not the Yom Kippur War? They are, in a sense, stuck in the past, failing to understand Israel and some of what is going on in the Middle East right now.
I think many members of what we call the foreign policy elite do have a sort of outdated view of the conflict. I think that's especially true of President Biden, who's, you know, been in politics for a long time now. And the sort of traditional view was that, you know, you had a weak Israeli David surrounded by a hostile Arab Goliath. It was a heroic country trying to survive against almost insurmountable odds. And that was never strictly true, actually, even back in the 1950s and 1960s. But you could make a pretty compelling case for it. And if you add that to the understandable sympathy that many people felt in the aftermath of the Holocaust in Europe, it, I think, supported a certain view of Israel as, you know, plucky, heroic country that deserves our help. But this isn't true anymore. This is completely out of date. Israel is now a wealthy country. I think it's 22nd in the world in per capita income. It has the strongest military in the Middle East, in part because it gets all this help from the United States. It has nuclear weapons, which it doesn't publicly acknowledge, but everybody knows it possesses. It has peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan and now a number of Gulf states, or at least diplomatic relations with some Gulf states. And there's been a tacit relationship with Saudi Arabia, even though they don't have formal diplomatic relations. All that's completely, it's a revolution in Israel's strategic situation that Americans haven't fully taken aboard. The problem, the fundamental problem Israel faces, and it's a very vexing and difficult one, is that you have roughly 7.5 million Israeli Jews who are completely controlling the lives of roughly 7.5 million Palestinian Arabs in the same area, right? If you count the Gaza Strip, Israel proper, and the West Bank. And while controlling the lives of those 7.5 million Palestinians, it's also trying to incorporate the West Bank into a greater Israel. And doing that requires building settlements. It also involves repeated crimes, including the crime of apartheid, efforts at ethnic cleansing, and now a possible genocide in Gaza. That's the problem. But the American political system hasn't quite caught up to that new reality. I'd add one other point here, which I think is significant, which is that Israeli politics has been moving steadily to the right since the 1990s as well. And, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu's political career is evidence of that. First becoming prime minister in, I think, 95 or 96, and by far the dominant political figure in Israeli politics ever since, longest serving prime minister in Israeli history. And that partly reflects the fact that politics has been moving to the right, in part because the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox population has been increasing as a share of the Israeli population. And that's why you now have this very right-wing coalition in Israel, which includes some really quite fanatical, you know, religiously inspired settlers. And that's not going to go away, right? That's the reality of the Israel we're dealing with today, which hasn't been fully, I think, incorporated into sort of American views, even views of the American elite. Last point, there are plenty of people in the foreign policy establishment, and I think Richard Haass, who you mentioned at the very beginning, is a good example of this, who understand this problem, understand what's going on. It's not that they're completely ignorant about trends in Israel or the politics of the situation or the problems caused by the occupation. But they understand that being too outspoken about it, by pushing for a different policy, pushing for a normal relationship between these two countries, they understand that that's a career killer in Washington. If you make that your stated position, you know, you're not going to get a job in government. You're not going to become president of the Council on Foreign Relations. You're going to be seen as some kind of a radical. You'll probably get accused falsely of being anti-Semitic, etc. So even people who understand the situation are often leery of saying what they think or pushing for policies that ultimately would be better for the United States, but also, I think, better for Israel in the long run.
And I take it that a Trump presidency, if that's what happens, is hardly going to push things in the direction that you're talking about.
No, a Trump presidency is not going to be any better. I don't think Donald Trump cares one way or the other about this issue, but he would put his finger in the wind and sense where the political winds were blowing and go that way. What's remarkable to reflect upon is that, in fact, the Biden administration and the Trump administration were not that different in their Middle East policy. Trump basically paid no attention to the Palestinian issue. As I mentioned, closed the American consulate in Jerusalem, pursued the so-called Abraham Accords, which was designed to sort of normalize relationship with Israel and put the Palestinian issue off to one side, just pretending it was going to go away. And with Saudi Arabia being seen as the big prize. What does Biden do? Well, Biden basically continued that policy. Didn't reopen the consulate, didn't try to restart a peace process, went all in to try and do a very complicated deal of a sort of U.S. security guarantee to Saudi Arabia that was going to be linked to a Saudi normalization with Israel. And once again, pretending that the Palestinian issue could be, kicked down the road for another decade or so. And as you probably know, the week before October 7th happened, the tragic events of October 7th, the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, published an article in Foreign Affairs magazine saying that the Middle East had, hadn't been this quiet, this tranquil, this peaceful in decades. And I think that indicates the way in which they misread what was really going on. My point simply being is there was really not much daylight between what Trump did and what Biden did. Now, October 7th, of course, has altered that equation in a variety of different ways, but I don't think you should expect a Trump presidency to get serious about trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. No evidence that he'd care.
Right. But if the theme of our conversation is, obviously this is a crisis, but it's a moment at which things have not only changed, but have been seen to be changing both in domestic politics and in terms of the relations between the various players in the Middle East. There is an opportunity here. But the implication of what we're talking about is that the only real solution is two states. And to go back to a conversation I had with a Palestinian I've known for many years, he said to me, the only problem with that is my family in 1948 were thrown out of what is called Israel proper, from the area around Jaffa, and we would like our land back. And you can see that the problems which have always existed are still there, even if there's a change in the way in which America configures this geometry.
So many of us have said for many years that the obvious solution here was two states for two peoples. And people disagree on how close we came to actually achieving that. Now you have to go back almost 25 years to find moments where it looked like we might have been close. And that still, in theory, is the best outcome because all the alternatives are worse. All right. You could solve the problem through extensive rounds of ethnic cleansing, drive all the Palestinians out. This is an enormous crime against humanity. You're talking about expelling millions of people from their homes. You can have permanent apartheid, more or less the situation we have today. Again, also a crime against humanity, and it's inevitably going to produce moments like the one we're in now. You could have a one-state solution. You could say, all right, these people are going to live together. Let's have democracy, one person, one vote. Everybody has equal equal political rights. And that's very appealing in sort of abstract terms. But binational states often have lots of problems within them. And given the history of the past 100 years, it's hard to imagine that being very workable anytime soon, you know, maybe 100 years from now. But I think that that's unlikely as well. Well, if those are all your alternatives, then you're left with the two-state solution. The problem is, first of all, the Israeli government, and in particular Benjamin Netanyahu, has devoted his political career to preventing this from happening. And even the most generous Israeli offer ever made was not really for a viable state. Finally, at least for the medium term, in my judgment, the fallout from what we're now seeing is going to make two states look like where we need to go and make it much harder to get there. Israelis, quite understandably, upset by what happened on October 7th, no trust whatsoever of the Palestinian leadership, deeply concerned that people who are in Hamas might eventually have a role in some Palestinian state. I have complete sympathy for why they think that, given what happened in October 7th. But of course, it's true on the other side as well, given what Israel has done in Gaza now. The Palestinian insistence on what they will need to feel safe and secure facing a much more powerful Israeli neighbor are going to go up as well, not to mention desire on both sides for revenge, for payback. So yes, it appears again in the abstract, like that's the solution we should all go to. The barriers, I think, to getting there have actually gone up. The one final point I'd make here is that with any kind of negotiation like this, any kind of bargain, nobody gets everything they want. Right? The Palestinians are not going to get the complete right of return to go back and reclaim every house that might have existed and been in their possession in 1947. The Israelis are not going to get everything some Israelis might want as well. There's going to have to be a willingness on both sides to accept less than what they might ultimately desire, and then to recognize that once a deal is reached, if it ever is, there are going to be many efforts made to derail it. The extremists on both sides are going to try to cause things to fall apart. They're going to conduct acts of violence to try and derail the train. We see this in lots of other conflicts, not just this one. So the people who make this deal have to be resolved to make it work, even in the face of the efforts that, again, extremists on both sides are likely to make to stop it.
I was lucky enough to be there in the 1990s when Yasser Arafat sat down with Yitzhak Rabin under American chairmanship, and they reached an accord. And they both went back to their own people, and Rabin was assassinated by someone who was an Israeli extremist. And that is the problem, isn't it? I mean, well, it's part of the problem that even with American pressure and even with a rethink on the American side, and even with the logic, as you've explained it, of the two-state solution, selling it to both the Israeli and Palestinian people, especially given the situation now or what is likely to obtain in the next few months, is going to be heck of a difficult, if not impossible.
No, and we saw, you know, the Oslo Accords were this great optimistic moment. And one of the things that derailed it was exactly what you point to, that there were acts by extremists on both sides. Hamas conducted a number of suicide bombings, which undercut the peace camp in Israel, drove support for rejectionists like Netanyahu as well. And an extremist Israeli-American, actually, Baruch Goldstein, assassinated or killed, you know, I think, 40 or so Palestinians on the Temple Mount at one point. So there were acts of violence on both sides, and then, of course, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin as well. And you have to factor that danger into account when you're trying to construct, ultimately, a political settlement here, and recognize that it isn't a situation where, you know, that we have the final signing ceremony, a flock of doves is released to fly across the sky, and everyone goes about their business. That the steps from the moment of agreement to actually implementing it and then making it work are going to take several years. And in that period, there are going to be efforts made to stop it. And the people, and I would include the United States here, have to be very resolute in saying, we can't go through another century of this conflict. We will all be better off if we can move beyond it and have these two populations living side by side and ultimately cooperating with each other. But getting there is going to require a level of leadership and resolution that we haven't seen in many, many years.
Indeed. Stephen, thank you very much. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Relations at Harvard University and author of The Hell of Good Intentions, American Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. I'm Gavin Essler. This is The Bunker. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Gavin Essler. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.